From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I don't buy your premise that there's going to be a civil war.
This was President Bush on Tuesday with Elizabeth Vargas of ABC News.
As you know, we've reduced troop levels this year, and that's because our commanders on the ground have said that the security situation in Iraq is improving because the Iraqis are more capable of taking the fight.
The security situation in Iraq has improved, the President of the United States says. An interesting analysis, following as it does the most deadly week of sectarian violence since the fall of Saddam Hussein. But as to the question the President was addressing, whether Iraq is verging on civil war, at least we can confidently mark him down for no. There are, however, other opinions on the subject.
Let's just start with Iraq. Give me your definition of where Iraq is right now. Is it in a civil war?
You've got something like a civil war happening over there in Iraq.
Is this the making of a civil war, or is all this civil war talk made up by the media?
The nature of the conflict in Iraq, its trajectory, and just what to call it were the media questions of the week. As has been the case since long before the U.S.-led invasion, the battles on the ground have been paralleled by battles of semantics. Stanford University professor James D. Furon is co-author of Ethnicity, Insurgency, and Civil War.
It looks like, by recent estimates, you know, at least 20,000 Iraqis killed in the fighting since we invaded, and probably more like 25 or 30,000. But even if you said 15,000, we'd be talking about, in comparative terms, a quite intense civil war.
This is not a novel formulation. Jonathan Landay, defense and intelligence correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers in Washington, says that before the war, many in the intelligence community contemplated that very scenario, and today regard it as having come to pass, or at least to the very brink.
One of those people is the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the top military intelligence agency, General Maples, who said as much to the Senate Armed Services Committee earlier this week in testimony. What he said was that the conditions for a civil war exist, but they don't believe that a civil war is actually raging at the moment.
The question is, where does the brink end and the catastrophic realization begin? The Washington Post, for one, has been cautious in its language. In a Tuesday story, it cited a body count of 1,300 directly attributable to sectarian violence, but stopped short of drawing linguistic conclusions. Keith Richberg is the Post's foreign editor.
I just think you have to be very careful when you throw these terms around. It's obviously sectarian violence. It's obviously getting worse. But we're not quite sure if civil war would be too strong a term. We tend to think it is just at the moment, since there are large sections of the country where there is no violence occurring. I mean, most of these executions we see are occurring in Baghdad and the four provinces around Baghdad. You can go into many large cities in Iraq, Najaf, Karbala, Nasiriya, Basra, and you're not going to see people openly fighting on the streets. So I think civil war to most people would conjure up something on a broader and more continuous scale than what we're seeing in Iraq now.
It's setting the bar pretty high, isn't it?
New Yorker magazine staff writer George Packer is author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq.
Every province has to be embroiled in the levels of violence that Baghdad is in right now before we can trot out the term and admit that it's a civil war. I mean, the South is pretty violent too. How many more corpses do there have to be before you're willing to call it a civil war?
You could say, what's the difference what the thing is called? The violence is what it is, and everything else is just wordplay. But wordplay is not irrelevant. So acutely aware is Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld of the politics of nomenclature that his Pentagon press briefings have been an ongoing war against word choice. At one time, he bristled at the term insurgency, dismissing violent attacks in Iraq as the work of a few dead-enders. Later, he complained that the term guerrilla imputed too much legitimacy to the bad guys.
I mean, my goodness, I don't think it's a guerrilla war. You may think so. I don't know if anyone at this table thinks so. It's an insurgency.
Oh, so it is an insurgency. Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not. As Joint Chiefs Chairman General Peter Pace discovered last fall, when he accidentally let the I word slip in front of the secretary.
Many times with the Iraqi armed forces in the lead, taking cities from the, have to use the word insurgent because I can't think of a better word right now.
Enemies of the Iraqi, legitimate Iraqi government. How's that?
What the secretary said.
But beyond the petty cynicism of political spin, says The New Yorker's George Packer, word choice can inform people's understanding of the underlying reality, not just in international public opinion, but to the Iraqis themselves.
To them, it was a dread term because it creates an atmosphere in which people feel they have to reach for their gun and their group in order to protect themselves. And the use of the term can actually accelerate the violence by creating that kind of social psychosis, which each group really does feel there's an existential threat, and it has to strike first or else it will be annihilated. That's the dynamic that sets countries into this downward spiral of a civil war, and it's partly a linguistic logic.
Even for the Bush administration, the term civil war raises basic policy issues far beyond a few Rumsfeldian quibbles.
If we're fighting an insurgency to defend a legitimately elected government, that's both morally and strategically a pretty clear position to be in. If we are there in large numbers in a country that is falling into civil war at its early stages, it's much harder to tell people back home as well as soldiers why we're there.
Harder to explain to the home front and harder to justify before history. Because in the end, it matters little whether the hostilities in Iraq are more like Lebanon in the 80s or Yugoslavia in the 90s or the Horn of Africa right now. What matters is what's happening and who is to blame.
Because our project in Iraq evolved into becoming a democratic, unified Iraq that would provide something like a wedge to change the politics of the Middle East. A civil war in Iraq goes in just the opposite direction. And it becomes a strategic problem for years and years. And not least for me, it becomes a moral disaster because we've left Iraqis in the worst possible state when we had responsibility. If Iraq has become a civil war, it's a complete failure.
President Bush says he believes otherwise. The leaders of Iraq's warring factions told him
that we've got to make a choice if we're going to have sectarian strife or whether or not we're going to unify. And I heard loud and clear that they understand that they're going to choose unification.
That's what he heard. But words are slippery beasts. Sometimes they wriggle out of your hands and out of control. It wasn't so long ago, after all, that the president landed a fighter plane on an aircraft carrier under the banner of an apparently unambiguous term. Mission accomplished. Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. He says language is used by governments and their opponents to highlight certain features of reality and suppress others.
Take the word regime. People spoke of the Saddam regime, for instance, or the Baghdad regime, rather than the government. And regime is a word that implies always a certain illegitimacy or instability. We talk, for instance, about the Latin American countries that have adopted democratic government. We describe as democratic regimes, but we don't talk about nations like France and Sweden and the UK as democratic regimes. They're just democracies. Language like that always carries a point of view, and the media use the words in ways that pretty much accord with the assumptions that government brings to them.
So do you believe that the media can and should be arbiters of what the right word choice is? Or should we be leaving this to politicians? How do we alight on just the right word?
In recent years, certainly the media has been willing, perhaps too willing, to adopt the administration's usage after the administration announced that they would no longer be talking about private Social Security accounts, but personal accounts. If you looked in the media in the 2 or 3 months after the administration made those announcements, the number of stories describing them as personal rather than private accounts doubled, which is a pretty clear indication of the government's influence. A lot of people in the media have taken to using death tax without quotation marks, without a little hedge like so-called, rather than estate tax. The American media were extremely reluctant to use what Rumsfeld called the torture word after the first Abu Ghraib stories came out. And this is while the European papers, even the right-wing, even Murdoch's papers in the UK were using torture, while the New York Times and the Washington Post for quite a while were dancing around that word out of a fear of either criticism from the administration or from, in particular, right-wing press watchdog groups.
Is it fair to say that he who controls the vocabulary really controls the debate?
I think that's fair to say, though I think people sometimes tend to look in the wrong place for that. I think the vocabulary that really matters here is a vocabulary about which the press is actually less aware and less sensitive than these phrases like private accounts or death tax and so on, where everybody's kind of keyed into the partisan significance of those phrases. So, look, when I look in the so-called liberal media, the Washington Post, the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, LA Times, in domestic political context, at the word values, I see that conservative values anywhere from 3 to 5 times as common as liberal values. And that's not a matter of some diktat coming down from the editor of those papers, nor is it really a matter of a conscious decision. It's just that values nowadays in American speech evokes conservatism rather than liberalism. And you can go on with that sort of thing. But those are the usages that I think really move public opinion or crystallize public opinion. And they're ones that the media adopts, I really think, without much thought.
All right, Jeff. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist and author of the forthcoming Talking Right, How Conservatives Turn Liberalism into a tax-raising, latte-drinking, sushi-eating, Volvo-driving, New York Times-reading, body-piercing, Hollywood-loving, left-wing freak show.
Coming up, vets are on the front line in the midterm elections. And a look at the oil industry's PR campaign. Is it too slick?
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's barely March in this midterm election year, but the media already are pawing the frozen ground for a juicy political narrative. Every campaign season, these narratives supply reporters with a handy theme around which they can organize their coverage. For example, Democrats in disarray or Republicans mired in scandal. But those seem a little tired, so the media were quick to pounce on a fresh narrative about an expanding field field of veterans running for Congress as Democrats. There have been heaps of newspaper stories, even a few on TV, about the more than 50 vets, at least 10 from the current war, who have united under the rubric Band of Brothers. That's the name of the political action committee formed by Democratic strategist and veteran Michael Lyon to support their campaigns.
In past cycles, we've struggled to have a voice on national security and homeland defense and the war in Iraq. These men and women have served in the military. They come into these 2006 elections with a built-in credibility.
So much credibility, says Lyon, that a Republican group called Progress for America has already launched an ad campaign to counter it, featuring returned vets and families of the fallen. No one at Progress for America returned our calls about their Midwest Heroes ad, but the message does seem to be our vets are better than your vets.
I fought in Iraq with the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing.
I was in Iraq for 18 months with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
I was in Iraq for 12 months with the 3rd Corps Support Command.
The media only reports the bad news, but American troops are making real progress, securing free elections and defending our country from radical al-Qaeda terrorists who want to destroy America, starting in Iraq.
I thought it was a very irresponsible ad, of course.
Michael Lyon.
I mean, they've enlisted the help of a woman who lost her son in the war in Iraq, and they have her going through a series of Republican talking points that have been summarily dismissed by both sides. Weapons of mass destruction, the nuclear program, things of that nature. So, yeah, it was a little alarming to see an ad like this in February.
So this new narrative that seeks to end Republican ownership of the national security issue is already under threat. But Lyon seems undaunted, even when faced with the recent history of iconic vets John McCain, Max Cleland, and John Kerry knocked flat by the GOP political machine.
Well, that's three. We have 55 men and women that they're going to have to do that to this time. And I think the strength's in numbers here. Every time they try that, if we have 55 men and women that are ready to stand up and say no more, we can push this stuff back forever.
That is, if they can make it through the primaries. So far, the Democratic leadership has thrown its weight behind just one Band of Brothers candidate, former Black Hawk helicopter pilot Tammy Duckworth, who lost both her legs and the use of an arm in Iraq. Now the Illinois Democrat is a media darling and a political star, even as she's upended the campaign of the Democrat already slated to run there. But the rest of the vets, running mostly in solid Republican districts, have no assurance the Democratic Party will ever show them the money. Consider the case of Marine Corps Major Paul Hackett, widely regarded as the inspiration for the group, who ran in a red Ohio district last summer in a special election and lost by just a hair.
He ran, Iraq War veteran, and ran very strongly in a very conservative House district, and the party ignored him. They didn't care.
Marcus Melitzis runs the Daily Kos, a very influential liberal website.
But what happened is that he inspired a lot of other veterans who were just now coming back from Iraq or had served in previous wars. He got dozens of emails from people saying, I want to do what you did. How do I do it?
How indeed. The Democratic leadership last month ordered Hackett to drop his Senate bid in favor of a 7-term Akron Democrat, and he did, albeit kicking and screaming. Meanwhile, as the Band of Brothers awaits the nod of their own party, it earns no more than a yawn from the Republicans.
Well, look, I mean, each of these people is running an individual race in an individual district, and in the majority of these districts, the voters prefer someone with an R behind their name, not a D.
Carl Forte is director of communications for the National Republican Congressional Committee. He says these Democratic veterans would have to win in order to wrest national security from the GOP, and they won't.
And if there was a real groundswell of support, then they would have raised more than the $40,000 they've raised so far. I think it'll be very clear once primary season occurs that half of these candidates will be gone, and by the time we get into September, there'll only be one or two or three at most that even have a potential long shot chance of winning.
In the case of the Band of Brothers, says Forte, it's not a case of too little too late, but too little too soon.
My contention is that voters don't pay attention to House races until after Labor Day of the election year, and anything you do before that kind of gets lost in the shuffle.
I think it's the narrative of late winter, basically.
Bill Powers writes for the National Journal, and he keeps a close eye on election year narratives and the media that love them. And he doesn't think the Band of Brothers has legs, at least not long ones.
I think it has tiny legs. It has some legs. It's walking on those legs now pretty nicely because it catches you off guard. I mean, it is a completely valid trend story. It's surprising. You know, no one expected all these vets to be running because vets haven't been running for office much in the last generation. And nobody expected them to be almost entirely Democrats.
Power says that if they can get some ad money, this is a story that will play better in commercials than in free media. Because, ironically, the better organized they get, the less appealing they'll be to campaign reporters, who will come to see the Band of Brothers narrative not as the grassroots effort it is, but as a manufactured political product.
You know, I can see some meta pieces coming on this, which have not yet happened. Sort of the meta narrative, which is, oh, sophisticated reader, let me tell you about how these Band of Brothers people in the back room are trying to pull the wool over the media's eyes on this group.
Meanwhile, the Tammy Duckworth story has been written so many times it's nearly played out. Besides, he says, there's a far more versatile narrative for the media to latch onto, a gift that will keep on giving straight through 2008.
I think the narrative is Bush.
How does he know?
Oh, gosh, it's in every story. I mean, every story on Bush's disastrous poll numbers mentions the midterm election, and every story that's about the midterm election talks about the president's poll numbers. He is the elephant in the room, you know, literally and figuratively in this case. It's all about, does he have any mojo left for the rest of his term?
So as these campaigning veterans, none of them veteran campaigners, struggle to maintain their own mojo, their biggest supporters take the long view. It may not happen in 2006, what with all those immovable Republican incumbents, and it may not happen much in 2008.
But hopefully within the next 10 years, some of these guys are going to be in office.
Marcus Melitzis of the Daily Kos says he'll keep their message afloat on his website and anywhere else he finds an opening in the media, because quite frankly, there's no other way.
I've been arguing for a while now that things such as protest marches are obsolete, that they're useless, because what really matters now is how do you reach people and how do you influence people, and you do that by using media.
The media is the battlefield, the political narrative, the big gun, and the future, a long, hard slog with many casualties. But Melitzis, a veteran himself, seems to be saying, as the president in fact did in one of his speeches, that he will settle for nothing less than complete victory, to which the Band of Brothers might add, if you ask them, that real soldiers don't cut and run.
...2005 was a good year for the American oil industry, and that's putting it lightly. ExxonMobil, the country's biggest oil company, announced year-end profits of $36.1 billion. That's 31% more than the previous year's record take, and it set the record for the most money earned in a year by an American company ever. Chevron was second, with a piddling $14.1 billion for the year. How they're spending their earnings is a somewhat contentious subject, but we do know that some of it is being funneled back into a major PR campaign designed to play down the size of the profits and play up the industry's goodwill.
While America's oil and natural gas industry earns less than many others, we've reinvested more than $1 trillion since 1992, part of an ongoing commitment using advanced technology to find new sources of energy.
The basic message of the ads is this. If you consider the profits as a percentage of the company's sales figures rather than as a lump sum, you'll see that the oil industry is actually far less profitable than many other industries like banking or real estate. It's a message partly aimed at federal lawmakers currently debating the creation of a new windfall profits tax. Red Cavaney is the president of the American Petroleum Institute, the group behind the ad campaign. He says such huge profits simply reflect the huge scale of an industry that has to be huge in order to compete with the state-run oil companies of foreign governments.
We control, as publicly held companies, only about 6% of the world reserves, and the national oil companies belonging to foreign governments control 77%. And so our companies have to be huge in scale in order to try and compete on somewhat of a level playing field. So our return, if you looked at the earnings per dollar of sales, have pretty much over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years been right about at the all industry average.
Tell me what exactly you and your members are doing to get the message out.
Well, it's multifaceted. What we're trying to do is to create opportunities where we can have discussion with opinion leaders, where we can have discussions with the media, where we can have discussions in community forums and the like, to try and explain to people what the industry is all about and the risks that are inherent in trying to go to some of the most difficult places on the face of the earth and explore and produce oil and natural gas. We're doing it in advertising in newspapers, on some television. We do a lot of work with editorial boards.
Now, the campaign has been going on in the wake of these just eye-popping profit numbers coming out. Is that what it's all about, trying to fend off a new version of the windfall profits tax before that kind of initiative can get any steam going in Congress?
No, it's not. First of all, the advertising and getting the word out on the industry began on a huge scale immediately following the two hurricanes, specifically initially Hurricane Katrina in early September. There had also been more modest scales of that before that period of time. Obviously, every quarter, companies report their earnings. So within a month of when we began our first full-scale effort here, yes, earnings reports started to come out, but this program was underway long before that, and the advertising component was related specifically to the immediate post-Katrina period and then continued from there.
Well, this has been going on now for some months, the campaign has, and I'm curious how you're regarding its success. Do you believe that the understanding of the dynamics of the oil industry is greater now? Have the editorials been less strident, say, in the last few months than they had been in the preceding few?
Well, I think what I can certainly say is that a number of editorial boards better understand the industry and what makes it work and what kind of policies are beneficial to trying to create a better environment. There's no question about that. In some cases, you see editorials that reflect some of the things that we've had to say, but whether those would have occurred or not, it's hard to connect the dots.
Let me share the experience of one consumer, me. When I juxtaposed the profits that ExxonMobil reported with what's going on at, you know, my local gas pump, my reaction was to kind of take one of your newspaper ads and roll it up in a ball and throw it across the room and say, hey, you want to impress me? Charge less. The profits would still be substantial, but the consumer wouldn't get the sense of being gouged. Am I missing something?
Yes, you are. What's important to understand is that 60% of the price of most of the fuels, gasoline, is a result of the price of crude oil, which is sold on the world market. And most crude oil is not produced in the United States. So our companies can't determine what that price is. So 60% of it is attributable to crude oil. Another 20% on average is attributable to federal and state taxes. And only 20% of that is attributable to the exploration, the production, the distribution, the refining, the blending, and the actual retailing of gasoline. So the price is not something that the oil companies have huge latitude over, which is why our earnings per dollar of sales are relatively small compared to what they're characterized as.
First of all, it's probably the first time in corporate history that an industry is trying to tell the American people that you can make more money investing in other industries.
That last voice was Tyson Slocum of the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. He says that Red Cavani and the rest of the oil industry are trying to pull a fast one on the American public.
It's disingenuous for them to claim that their record profits are actually far lower than other industries, because the methodology that they're using to calculate profits when they're doing this PR campaign is a much different methodology than the one that they use to calculate profitability when they're talking to Wall Street and they're talking to their shareholders.
What are they saying to Wall Street? What different metric are they using to impress that crowd?
Well, when they're talking to the general public, they are taking their income and measuring it as a share of sales. But to shareholders, they don't talk about profits as a share of revenues. In fact, they say directly in their annual report, they say ExxonMobil believes that return on average capital employed is the most relevant metric for measuring financial performance in a capital-intensive industry such as petroleum. So what return on average capital employed is measuring is what is the profit margin, what is the rate of return on our capital investment in our operations? And there we have a much different number. In 2005, they had a 30% profit margin when you compared net income to average capital employed. And that's for their global operations. ExxonMobil's profit margin for their U.S. operations, when measuring profits as a share of capital investment, was 46% rate of return on their U.S. oil production activities and a 59% profit margin on their U.S. oil refining operations. Those are clearly windfall profit figures.
In the oil industry's PR offensive, there have been basically three prongs. One is the argument that our profit margins aren't that high to begin with. The second is that we're all in this together and we must conserve, and to the extent that we can conserve on energy consumption, it will put less price pressure due to supply and demand. And the third is that these windfalls will give the oil companies the cash they need to find new sources of oil, both here and abroad. What do you make of the argument that this cash is all going to be siphoned into R&D?
I don't see that these record profits are being poured back into research and development. I mean, first of all, profits are after investments are made into research and development. Profits are going to payments to shareholders in the form of dividends and bigger bonuses to top executives. And also, we've got to remember that the president himself said in his most recent State of the Union address that America is addicted to oil. So why should Americans be paying record high prices for energy products only to see the oil industry only invest in feeding our addiction?
Now, when ExxonMobil came out with its gatrillion-dollar profit report, there was some spike in interest in the press. But the story has, as far as I can tell, pretty much petered out. To what do you attribute that?
The PR campaign has definitely helped. The fact that the oil industry's, you know, $55 million in campaign contributions to members of Congress and the White House since 2001 has purchased the industry a certain amount of immunity. I mean, we can all remember that when the five oil executives were finally brought before Congress back in November to defend their record profits, the Congress did not force them to testify under oath. That is just one small example of the kind of special treatment that the industry gets. And so if Congress isn't making a whole lot of noise about having to hold the oil companies accountable, then the media isn't going to be generating a lot of stories on the subject.
Okay, Tyson. Well, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Bob.
Tyson Slocum is the director of the energy program at the Washington Consumer Advocacy Group, Public Citizen.
Up next, why there's so much mud wrestling in the White House briefing room and 20 years of amusing ourselves to death.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the White House press wants answers and the White House spokesman doesn't deliver, the briefing room becomes bedlam. Here's NBC's David Gregory with Press Secretary Scott McClellan.
I'm sure I have questions.
I understand that, but I'm not getting answers here, Scott. And I'm trying to be forthright with you, but don't tell me that you're giving us complete answers when you're not actually answering the question, because everybody knows what is an answer and what is not an answer.
David, now you want to make this about you, and it's not about you. It's about what happened, and that's what I'm trying to provide answers to the questions.
There's something about those briefings that brings out the beast in nearly everyone. One such beast was ABC newsman Sam Donaldson. His first stint in the press room spanned 1977 to 1989, the second from 1998 to 1999, when the briefings first went live. He joins us now to relive that experience. Sam, welcome to the show.
Happy to be with you, Bob.
When you returned to the White House in 98, I gather it was a very different place than the one you had left a decade earlier. How much did the live camera figure into that?
I think it was a great impact on the briefing process, and I think negatively, and I've thought that for years, and I noticed the other day that Mike McCurry, the man who had instituted that process, said he thought it was one of his mistakes, and I agree.
Why?
Well, in the White House briefing room, the press secretary for whichever administration, doesn't matter, comes out to say only what the president wants him to say and no more. And, of course, reporters want to know more and want to talk about maybe the bad news, not just the good news. So it can get very tense at times, and you go back and forth. And when people see this on television, they say, well, what are these nasty, vicious dogs of the press doing assailing that fine, upstanding individual who's press secretary of the president? And it just really doesn't help the process.
Now, the other day, the nice young man was Scott McClellan, who strongly insinuated that David Gregory of NBC was playing to the cameras, or at least was in the habit of playing to the cameras. Do you see your colleagues doing that in those briefings?
I guess I have to admit, Bob, that if you're on television, you play to the cameras and you know the cameras are there. But I don't think that's the reason why David Gregory or anyone else in the press room really starts out after the press secretary to try to get the facts. And as I say, it can get very tense. I can remember times when I was there when there was no television, when we'd go, Helen Thomas and I and others would go round and round with Larry Speaks or even Marlon Fitzwater, who was one of the very best. And you'd hurl, well, you're not telling the truth here. What do you mean I'm not telling the truth? Don't you accuse me of not telling the truth? I can remember an exchange like that. So I don't think this is something new that just comes about because the cameras are there.
Well, let me make a proposition in defense of having cameras in that room. It seems to me that if the reporters are asking questions and the press secretary is deflecting them, dodging them, or what have you, it's nice to see Scott McClellan, in non-answer to David Gregory's question, say something along the lines of this administration wants to focus on the priorities of the American people and put the Cheney shooting behind us. Isn't it to the, benefit of media and democracy to watch those questions not being answered in real time?
You have a point. And if all the viewers were discerning, or the majority of them were discerning, and they watched daily and they understood the issues and went back and forth and saw that the press secretary was dodging something, because most press secretaries are very artful. They will simply say, for instance, the president has said as long as the ongoing investigation continues, it would be inappropriate for him to say anything. Well, that sounds very reasonable. But of course, if you point out that the president last week in fact commented on the investigation when it served his purpose, then you're going to have this little fight with the press secretary. And so I think at first glance, people watching, when they see that little fight develop, may not say to themselves, aha, this press secretary is dissembling, is doing the light fantastic. They will simply say, at least it's been my experience, that they say, well, why are you being so mean? I mean, he's answered the question. Why do you keep persisting with the very same question that he's answered? I don't understand. Have you got an agenda?
So in terms of media literacy, what the public has to understand is, sure, you can watch these briefings, but you really should stay tuned for the resulting story, because it will at least attempt to put things in perspective and not just show an ongoing tit-for-tat between the spokesman and a group of reporters.
Well, I think that's right, because after all, if you're reporting on the presidency, it's important to be at the briefings, but that's only one part, and sometimes it's the very smallest part of assembling facts for the story. But as you assemble the other facts for your story, people aren't being there to watch. They're not able to see you make the telephone calls that might give you the vital piece that clarifies things. To have people watch only a small portion of the process of collecting the story, and one where you are contentious and disputes arise and voices are raised, that it really doesn't serve the public well.
All right, Sam. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
Sam Donaldson, among many other achievements in his storied career, was twice a White House correspondent for ABC News.
Mike McCurry, the man to blame for the decision to go live, joins us now. He served as press secretary for President Clinton for 4 years, shuffling and sidestepping like the best of them, but respected by the press, perhaps because he let those cameras roll, perhaps because he seemed genuinely frustrated by presidential mendacity, or perhaps because he quit in 1998, declaring he was out of the loop on the Lewinsky scandal. Mike McCurry, welcome to OTM.
It's great to be with you.
So over the course of the last several big news stories, we've seen the White House briefing room transformed from the most boring and uninformative of venues to one that's far livelier, though equally uninformative.
Well, I tell you, that place, you know, many listeners may not know, it's built over a former swimming pool. And there are times when you're standing up there as press secretary, you'd like a trap door to open so you could plunge into the deep end, because that's where you feel like you are.
And you take some blame for that situation, don't you? You were quoted in Catherine Seeley's New York Times piece on Monday saying that allowing those briefings to be aired live on TV was, quote, a huge error on your part.
Look, I think if I had put a simple ground rule on that initial decision to allow coverage, it would have made for a much different environment. If I had said, look, this is all available for coverage, you can use it in your stories, but let's not have live transmission of these proceedings, because that will get in the way of us being able to explore thoroughly certain subjects.
Why would it?
Because then journalists would have to do what good journalists do. They would have to use editorial judgment in picking out the things that really are important that the public needs to know versus those things that are just mildly entertaining.
So you're saying you would prefer to have the media filter, as Bush puts it, bearing down on this process?
It's a, you know, ironic admission, but I would. I would, at the end of the day, rather put my trust in people who are going to try to go and scan all the information that's available and then put it in some coherent frame for the consumer, for the citizen, than to just kind of give this incoherent taste of what goes on in that briefing room that nobody can really understand because you're not part of the game.
But certainly you must have assumed that some benefit would accrue to the White House. I know that CNN told you that when you were on the air, they got 100,000 extra households tuning in.
Sure. There was a lot of self-interest in the decision, not the least of which I really enjoyed the idea of being a momentary matinee idol on C-SPAN. But you're right, that the ability to frame a response through all the media that's available, that did advantage the White House.
But I guess pretty soon after you decided to roll those briefings live, the Monica Lewinsky scandal happened, and probably you would have been happier if you had less regular exposure to the press.
Once it became a live televised event in the days of Monica Lewinsky, I think it lost a lot of its usefulness because people were putting on a show. I was, you know, putting on a show, standing there as the beleaguered aide, trying desperately to get off to a different subject. The press had to hone in and bore in on what was the scandal du jour. And it ceased to become what a news briefing ought to be, a way in which we can pass information to the media so that they can then report and get the information to the public. My fear is most citizens watch this and it just adds to their sense of despair that, you know, Washington is screwed up and people don't get it there because what they're talking about doesn't have anything to do with what my life is about. I mean, if you watch the endless, endless questions about Dick Cheney and his hunting trip, you would just have to scream at the television set.
It's because the print reporters there want an actual usable quote that advances the story, and McClellan isn't doing it, so they'll hammer away. The TV people will hammer away for their own reasons. The whole reporting process becomes distorted, you say, by the liveness of this event. And in fact, some reporters say that they don't like it at all, that they would really prefer that people don't watch them work.
Look, those reporters know, because they're told regularly by the outfits that survey this, for example, the Pew Charitable Trust, that have done a lot of work on what are public attitudes towards the media. They know that the media as an institution has been in decline, just like government itself. There's less trust, less favorable reaction to the work that gets done. And I think that's in part because we're letting too much of the sausage being seen made. My other concern is now it seems like the entire federal government, which is a vast enterprise, is being filtered through that one room where there's a podium and a handful of reporters. And it, you know, we're losing a lot of the coverage of all the other aspects of government that need to be in front of the American people.
All right. Thanks very much.
Good being with you.
Mike McCurry was press secretary for President Clinton. Here are some of his final words from the podium.
I was determined when that story broke back in January was to never come here and do what some of my predecessors unfortunately did, which was to lie to you and mislead you. And sometimes not knowing the answer, even though that puts you in a tough position too, is better than consciously misleading people. You know, did I ever knowingly come here and send you folks in the wrong direction? I did not.
The late media critic Neil Postman argued in his seminal book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, that as TV prevailed over the printed word, it impaired our ability to make sense of a world of information. He observed that there was no subject so serious, be it war or faith or the future of the nation, that it could not be reduced to tasty, if incoherent, info bites. Exhibit A was the nightly news, which he said featured, quote, a type of discourse that abandons logic, reason, sequence, and rules of contradiction. He went on, in aesthetics, I believe the name given to this theory is Dadaism. In philosophy, nihilism. In psychiatry, schizophrenia. In the parlance of the theater, it is known as vaudeville. Jay Rosen writes the blog PressThink.org and is a professor in the journalism department of New York University, where Postman taught. Rosen counts Postman as both mentor and hero, and Amusing Ourselves to Death, now in a new edition, as ever more relevant. He says Postman never wavered in his belief in the superiority of the printed word.
It was in print that we learned how to make an argument cohere. It was in print that we learned that we could classify what we know and therefore make it available to us in a convenient way. And it was through print that we learned how to sustain an idea, sustain an argument over a long stretch of mental time so that our descriptions of the world could be as complex and nuanced as the world that we found out there. And as we moved from an oral to a writing to a print culture, Postman saw human intelligence and human character improving up to a point. And then a reversal began.
Now, the improvement that you're talking about is an increased emphasis on rationality.
Mm-hmm.
Postman talks about how changing technologies changed our relationship with what we call news.
In the era of newspapers, the information available to people was very connected to things they had to do. The original newspapers were meant for the trading classes, people who had decisions to make. The kind of news they learned about and the kind of life they led matched in some way. That lasted up until the mid-19th century. And what he says in the 20th century is that it's completely out of whack.
News from everywhere,
mm-hmm.
In which no action is called for.
Well, Neil has a very wonderful phrase for this. He says that information began to come to us that answered no question we had asked. And I think that puts it very, very well. The thing about the mass media and their reach across the globe is that they can furnish us with episodes and eruptions that don't have any necessary connection to our lives, but might connect to us as human drama, or as we sometimes say, pure entertainment.
Okay, so that brings us to the nightly news. News has now become nuggets, he felt, that had little relevance to us that we can't act on.
Right.
And he dissects the classic news format, which we know hasn't changed, the content of it, the music of it, the anchors and their demeanor.
Yes, he paid attention, not to the things most critics write about, sound bites, inaccuracies, sensationalism, but to these other very small things, like the music that sets the tone, for the muse, has this enormous influence on sort of orienting us and telling us what kind of space we are in. He paid attention to the lead-ins and the intersections of one segment and another, because in those moments of transition, television gave us its idea of how things were related to one another.
Or not.
Or not. That's why he made such a big deal, I think, properly, over the phrase, "and now this."
As he wrote, "There's no murder so brutal, no earthquake so devastating, no political blunder so costly, for that matter, no ball scar so tantalizing or weather report so threatening that it cannot be erased from our minds by a newscaster saying, now this."
When he looked at television, what he saw was no ethic of care whatsoever about the order or depth or meaning of each piece of data or image or segment that came through. And there was something about that, just the sheer randomness of it, that he saw as a kind of violence against us.
Now, Jay, the name of your blog, Press Think, is a word George Orwell might have coined. In fact, in the foreword to Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman says that we shouldn't be afraid of Orwell's dark vision of the world, as expressed in the novel 1984. What we should fear, actually, is Aldous Huxley's dark vision, as expressed in Brave New World. So what's the distinction that he was trying to draw here?
Neil was very concerned about how we lose things that are precious to us, including our freedoms. And these two books presented two different ways that could happen. It was Orwell's view that people could be controlled through power and coercion and intimidation, confusing their minds and getting them to accept lies. In Brave New World, people are not denied things. They're given whatever they want on the principle that pleasure is good, and why shouldn't we occupy ourselves with the things that bring us joy and sensation? It was Huxley's view that people could be controlled that way. Huxley thought he was describing something potential in the world, and Neil thought he was describing something that had arrived and was here.
Jay, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University and writes the blog PressThink.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ani Katz and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.